Activia offers a range of yogurts which are a delicious way to look after your gut health. From the fruit range with carefully selected ingredients to no added sugar and 0% fat offering, as well as a cereals range, there's an Activia for everyone. Made with a unique blend of 5 ferments, creating an irresistibly creamy texture, each pot of Activia is a source of calcium, making it the perfect addition to your daily routine. Activia helps support a healthy gut. Your gut is where it all begins.
Here, and so is the hottest sale of the year at Easy Living Furniture. Absolutely everything reduced across sofa, dining, bedroom, mattress and accessories. The spectacular summer sale is now on at Easy Living Furniture. Find your local store online at easylivingfurniture.ie.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, Easy Living has it all.
Easy Living Furniture. Luxury furnishings, affordable luxury.
You're listening to Real Health with me, Carl Henry, in association with Activia. Activia offers a range of yogurts that help support a healthy gut. Your gut is where it all begins. Hello and welcome to Real Health. Before we get into the podcast, if you want to win a €500 one for all voucher, head to mypodcastfeedback.com, pop in the code health and fill out the short survey for the chance to win a €500 one for all voucher. Folks, a cancer diagnosis can be the worst news someone receives, but a new book titled The Cancer Guide tells us all you need to know about nurturing your well-being through and beyond the diagnosis. The author, Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer, is clinical professor at Trinity College Dublin and a psychiatrist, and she joins me now in studio. Anne-Marie, thank you so much for coming in. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
A scary topic, isn't it? Cancer, a diagnosis of cancer. I've been through it with lots of people kind of through work and beyond. It's a frightening thing for people to go through.
Yes, and I think you've made my start very easy because that's what this book is all about. It's the human response to cancer, the psychological response to cancer, which, as you say, it's still such a scary concept. And I think for everyone listening out there, just to say, which I know you know, is that actually in 2024, the management and rates for cancer are so much better than they were even 20 years ago. We're picking cancer up early. The treatments are so much better. People are lasting for longer and the cure rates are excellent. But as you say, it's still a very, very scary concept, a very scary word. There's people that won't even use the word cancer. And that's what I'm interested in, is that human and psychological response to cancer. And in fact, as you've said, fear is probably the strongest human response, more than fear, terror, actually. And people often say that when they hear the words, you know, you've got cancer, they can't breathe. They feel like all the air has been sucked out of the room. It's like being hit by a bus. They say their whole life goes up into the air and they're waiting to see what will happen next. And the important other thing to say, so many things I'd like to say, but the other thing to say is, of course, cancer never affects just one person. So there's a person with cancer in the middle, and then there's all the people around them in ever-increasing circles. So the people who are really close to them, who are also terrified, distressed, grief-stricken on behalf of the person with cancer, sometimes even more so. Sometimes people will say, I wish it were me, especially if it's somebody younger than them. And then there's people beyond that, their family, friends, the people they work with, the people in their local groups or clubs, all of whom know about the diagnosis and they're wondering how to help, what to say and what to do. So it really affects a huge number of people.
And that reaction, just in case there's anyone who's listening and who has been through that and has reacted that way, it's a very natural reaction.
Yes, again, you're helping me hugely with that question. It is a very natural reaction, but you say that, Carl, but lots of people don't actually really know that, or they don't believe it. So often people, because this is what I've spent my life working in this area, listening to people with their psychological response to cancer, and they say, if only I had known, if only I had known that actually it's very normal to be terrified, overwhelmed, angry, grief-stricken. I wish that I had known that everybody else, that this is a normal response, because lots of people hide their responses. So most people that I used to see would say to me, oh, everybody else is so much better than I am. They're actually not. Most people are struggling hugely, but people hide it. And actually, you usually do not know what's going on in other people's lives. So it's a very common response.
At the start of the book, you speak directly to the reader. A really interesting way to open a book, because there's certain things you want to tell them.
Yes, I want to tell them some of the things that we've just been saying. I want to say that it's very common to be very distressed, to have a very prominent psychological response to cancer, that they are not alone, that lots of other people feel in that way, and that it's important for them to have information. Information is power. But it has to be the right information. I mean, so often people come in and say, oh, apparently with cancer you should, and my heart sinks, because it's usually going to be something that's either completely undoable, like juicing grasses and the
Dr.
Andes.
Google or something along those lines.
Or something that's just unhelpful. And so information is power, not just for now, but also for people with cancer, for planning for the future. So very often people have this image of how they're going to be in 6 months' time. And often that's not how they are. And then they're hugely disappointed when they get there and there's this big mismatch. So information is power, but it has to be the right information. And I have listened to people over more years than I'm willing to admit on the podcast. And so this is about sharing people's real life stories of what it was like for somebody with cancer and how they managed.
Some people, when they're diagnosed, they almost try to own it themselves, don't they? And take that route that I'm going to deal with this. I'm not going to trouble my family, my partner, my workplace, that, you know, this is my thing. And they almost go down that kind of rabbit hole with it. And that tends not to be the way to go.
Well, I think I'm very careful with my words, as you'll hear, because people listen very carefully to what people say, and particularly if they think that you're somebody that's dealt with cancer. So I've always very much feel you have to listen to the person in front of you. And really, if somebody has behaved in a particular way all their lives, they're not suddenly going to change. So if they're a very private person and they don't like sharing or having lots of chats, then they're not going to suddenly become a social butterfly, especially in the face of cancer. So to a degree, we must respect what people want to do and how they do it. But what I would say is one of the many myths is, you know, if I talk to my family, it's only going to upset them and make them worse. And this is just not true. Because actually, if you're very close to someone, they know. They know, they're distressed on your behalf, and they often want to share with you. And if you don't share, then you've got two problems. First of all, you're missing out on the huge support that your family would give you if you're close to them. And second of all, you've got the stress of trying to hide it, which is so unhelpful. So, you know, talking to my family will only upset them. No, they're already upset. They know. So if you feel able to share, then it's really important to share.
What other myths do you come across from a professional level? And you bring some of them in the book, you chat through. Chat us through a few more of them.
There are so many myths. Thank you for allowing me.
You lit up when I asked that question.
So the first myth that most distresses me is the myth, I must be positive all the time.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So if you meet somebody who's positive all the time, Carl, do introduce them to me because I'd love to meet them. Mm-hmm. It's not possible in everyday life.
On a social media perspective, it exists, though, doesn't it?
And well,
we talk about this with people all the time, that, you know, that social comparison, the compare and despair concept of they're living the dream in their lovely house with their perfectly clean and their five fabulous kids and their car, whatever. It's not true. None of it's true.
Yes. Well, I'd love to go there and meet them and see the house. It's not possible. Yeah. You know, life is messy. Life is unfair, which is another thing that people with cancer feel very strongly about. But coming back to the myths, so I must be positive all the time. It's just not possible. And it's particularly not possible if you've got cancer. And the problem with that particular myth is then if they're not positive, they're saying to me, oh God, I'm very anxious today. I'm very upset. Oh, that's terrible. That's going to make my cancer worse. Or worse, if their cancer comes back, they say, oh, it's because I was stressed. If I hadn't been stressed. So it's a really, really, there are many unhelpful myths, but it's my number one most unhelpful myth. And the second half of that myth is, I must be positive all the time if I'm going to beat my cancer. Now, if you're somebody that loves the battle analogy, off you go, use it. But most people do not feel they're fighting a battle. They feel like they're trudging in to get out of bed in the morning, tie their shoelaces and make their way in to sit and have their treatment and endless waits. And the problem with the battle analogy is if things don't go so well for them, they feel they've somehow lost the battle, and that's somehow their fault.
So it becomes toxic positivity becomes almost toxic itself.
Yes. Yeah. So that's my number. There's lots more, but that's my number one myth that I would like to get out there to dispel.
And from our chat already, it's trying to reassure people to be kind of kind to themselves, isn't it? That being anxious is okay. Having a bad day, that's okay too.
Do you know what? Some anxiety is helpful.
Yeah.
Because anxiety prompts us to react in particular, gets us out of bed in the morning, gets me here on time for my podcast.
We were both anxious today coming into this podcast, I'm sure. I get anxious every time I come up on the train to record these episodes. It's part of life and it revs you up a little bit.
It does rev you up. Now, of course, there's going to be people listening saying, yeah, that's okay, but what about overwhelming? Of course, like everything in life, it's about a balance. Mm-hmm. A little anxiety is helpful. Too much anxiety is overwhelming, and so many people struggle with terror. And that is very unhelpful. So, you know, it is about a balance.
And one of the things that's important to say around cancer is that no two cancers are the same.
Yes, that is very important for people that are listening. So there are so many things to say about that. No two cancers are the same. So first of all, you know, lung cancer is very different from prostate cancer. Breast cancer is very different from bowel cancer. So each of the cancer types are different. And even within that, within, say, lung cancer, there's lots of different types mm-hmm. of lung cancer, lots of different causes. And then the person with people differ. So everybody is different. People's responses are different. So it's extremely unhelpful to compare yourself with everybody else. It really is. People are different. The cancers are different. The treatments are different. So just focus on yourself and how you're doing and how you are going to move forward in this very difficult situation. How are you personally going to move forward with that?
And of course, in terms of cancer, then it's early prevention, isn't it? It's knowing your body. It's being aware of your body. From my own perspective, I had a dodgy mole on my right arm about, that must have been 4 or 5 years ago, maybe. And it changed texture. And I went in to Nikki Ralph, actually, who we had on the show, who she took it out. And she's going a second time and take more out because it wasn't all out. And it was fine. But actually, it's that awareness piece is the first thing, isn't it? And the psychology of being aware of your body. And,
yes.
And having that knowledge of checking yourself and checking for lumps and checking for bumps, that kind of self-awareness is important.
It's very important. And it's very important if you are worried about something to do something about it. Because if you don't, you've got, again, a double whammy. First of all, you'll be worried for months trying to ignore this lump that you found. And second of all, you'll delay a potential intervention. So if you have something you're worried about, go to your GP, tell them you're concerned, because only one of two answers are possible. Either it's not cancer, in which case you're done and dusted and you move on and you move on with other aspects of your life, or you do have cancer, which I accept is a very frightening thing to even consider, but you will then have picked it up early and you'll be able to start on your recovery plan.
For those thoughts then, on with that diagnosis, that's a really important aspect. One of the reasons I'm sure that you wrote the book in terms of the cancer guide, that how you react to that and initially and how you deal with the stressful thoughts and the mental side of the whole thing is crucial. It's so important.
It's very important. And it's funny, it's interesting. I've been talking in libraries throughout Ireland about this. And as part of that, I had to choose some of the stories to read because I couldn't read them all. And I realized after a while that the stories I'd chosen, every story, the cancer was either gone or not a severe cancer, but the psychological price that mm-hmm. people were paying was very high. And it's so, so important to look at that. These were people who were either cured from their cancer or about to be cured from their cancer, or their cancer had vanished completely. And yet it was their psychological, it was their thoughts, it was their fears, it was their emotional responses that were holding them back and were often crippling their lives. So they had their lives back, but not fully, because their lives were so hampered by these thoughts or behaviours or feelings or emotions that they had.
And bring us through some of the strategies then that maybe they would have used to deal with that issue, that maybe when the cancer was gone, that they still struggled with the emotional impact of the process. Like, we had a guest, Karen Kruger, in about probably 2 months ago. I remember she had cancer and she came in and spoke about that. For her, she felt that lack of support. It was like, you're fine. See you later now. And off you go. And that was a void for her that she really struggled to fill, because she wasn't fine. Mentally, yeah. She wasn't fine. Emotionally, she wasn't fine. Physically, she might have been perfect, but the process took so much out of her.
So that is, again, a very helpful introduction for me to talk about something else that I feel very strongly about, which is the end of treatment. So, you know, of course, when people start on their chemotherapy and they or their surgery and they hear, right, 6th of September, you'll be done. And they think, fabulous, fabulous. I'll just close my eyes and get through the next 6 months and get through it. And they tell their family and their friends and everybody plans a day. And in their minds, they imagine themselves hopping around the place, skipping and dancing, having a party. And then they get there and they're exhausted. Mm-hmm. It's the first chance they've had to think about what's happened to them. And they sit down and think, what have I just been through? You know, I've looked death in the face. That's the first thing. The second is they're wrecked physically, usually completely exhausted, demoralized, can hardly get out of bed. And then suddenly everybody's saying to them, oh, you must be delighted, your cancer's mm-hmm. done. And as you've mentioned there, they suddenly lose the support of the hospital because the hospital has said to them, you know, you treat, off you go. And those weekly trips to the day ward, which they found so difficult, getting their chemotherapy, they suddenly really miss them because instead of the nurses saying, you're grand, you're fine, well done you, keep going.
And that's really important, isn't it? That's the medical staff role in this whole process that you go through.
Yes. I mean, I think the medical staff, we have to be so careful, as I've said, because we have to remember all the time that we're dealing with people who are very, generally, very vulnerable. Generally, people who, you know, they're out of their comfort zone, they don't know about health, and now they've got cancer and they're very worried and very concerned and very afraid. So the words we use, we should choose with care. And I do talk about doctors are human too, not because I say doctors, it's healthcare workers, but doctors, because I'm a doctor.
Well, and we all are.
That. Yeah,
absolutely.
I understand that. Yeah. But yes, but you see, the problem is when somebody comes into a hospital setting and they're anxious and worried, if they meet somebody, their doctor, for example, and their doctor looks afraid or anxious or nervous or angry or upset or whatever, they think, oh.
It's amplified, of course. Yeah.
Oh, my results must be terrible. I mean, they said I was fine, but they don't really think that. So it's just to say to patients, you know, doctors should, healthcare workers should always have a bland, you know, appearance, but sometimes life leaks through for them as well. So just try to remember, it may not be anything to do with you at all. You absolutely are doing fine, and not to go home and dwell on that. Oh, the doctor passed me in the corridor and didn't smile. You know, my appointment next week is going to be terrible. So that's what that's about.
And when you get that news of, you know, you're cancer free, that isn't almost the end of the race. That's the beginning of the race, isn't it? Because that's where the rehab starts.
Very much so. So I really say to anybody listening, the end of treatment is the start of reclaiming your life and rehabilitation, which I know you'll be very interested in, Carl. So it's physical rehabilitation, which I'm sure your listeners are all...
We do it with lots of clients, and we have done over the years. We've worked with so many clients during pre-diagnosis, during diagnosis and post-diagnosis to rebuild.
And absolutely. You see, you say rebuild because you know that. But people who have just had cancer the first time, they don't know, they don't think about that. And they have to rebuild every aspect of their life, their physical health, but also their social world. You know, they've stepped out of this crazy world that we're all used to managing all the time. And now they've got to step back into it physically, mentally, socially, psychologically. It's a very big ask. So I say a minimum of 6 months rehabilitation. Now, I had somebody to talk in Limerick the other day say, oh, that's not long enough. Well, I don't mind 6 months, 12 months.
Yep.
So long as people say...
But it's not overnight.
It's absolutely not overnight. And the end of treatment is the start of reclaiming your life. And for people listening, you know, lots of people say, I'm going to reclaim my life, but not the way it was before. I'm going to use this to move forward in a different way. That is so important. People say, yeah, I was hit by a bus. Yes, my life was in pieces. But you know what? When I put those pieces back together again, they're going to be in a different order. I don't want to spend 5 hours a day commuting or 50,000 hours a week working. There are people that I met that used to make me feel awful. I'm not going to meet them anymore or, you know, I'm going to change whatever. So I think it's very important that people take that time to physically rehabilitate, socially rehabilitate, to look at their lives and perhaps, if they want to, change direction. If they don't want to, that's also fine. It's whatever works for them.
How important is talk therapy with a professional during and kind of post-diagnosis?
So
Or is that for some people it's very beneficial?
Exactly. Yes. So I'm always walking this tightrope. Carl.
That's okay. We'll mind you. I won't land you anywhere.
No. Yeah. I don't mean to land me, no, but I mean that I'm saying that in a very open way. This title, since I came back in 2000, of on the one hand saying mental health is so important, psychological health is so important, we must take note of it. In cancer, it's in everything, mm-hmm. but cancer, it's vital. There is no health without mental health. There really isn't. That I know that's a cliche, but it's so true. So I say that on the one hand. Yeah. Then on the opposite side, it is to not undermine people's own coping mechanisms, to make them feel so powerless that they must go and see a professional yep. to manage everything. We developed a model in James's for this. And at the top of the model, which is where most people are, actually what they need is time and support from their family and friends to manage what is absolutely a catastrophic event for so many people. But not every single person must go down to the bottom of the pyramid mm-hmm. and speak to a psychiatrist mm-hmm. or a psychologist. So it's that balance of, and I think that's why these talks are so helpful, I hope, to acknowledge that yes, psychological well-being is really important. And if you're not in a good space mentally, you cannot have your life back. But sometimes that means just reflecting, having information, knowing that it's okay to have, as you said earlier, terrible days where you don't feel good, where you feel low, but thinking how you might manage that with family and friends or getting information from a good source, not necessarily automatically having to go to see a professional. So it's a balance. It's like everything in life.
And we've chatted very much about a cancer diagnosis from the patient's perspective.
Yes.
But the family and the loved ones, it's challenging for them too.
I'm sure
there's contents in the book that's written for them also.
Honestly, it's so challenging for them. And again, I'm choosing my words with care here because there'll be people listening who have got cancer and they do not need more burdens put on them of saying it's very hard for their family and friends, even though they will know that. But it is very hard, especially for close friends. And so people always say, what can I do? So there's a number of things I would say. First of all, in terms of speaking to people who have cancer, speak less and listen more. Say less. Be guided by the person with cancer. Sometimes they want to talk about it. Sometimes they don't. And if they change the conversation, they do not want to speak about their cancer. Mm-hmm. Follow their lead. I could say more about that. I'll come back to it if you want to. But the other things that family and friends can do are practical things. And doing practical things helps the person psychologically because the stress of thinking, you know, who's going to walk the dog, who's going to feed the children, who's going to do the shopping, who's going to do the school runs, who's going to supervise his homework, whatever it is. So, for example, practical things like nominating one person in the family to organise the rotas, to have somebody deliver meals on every Wednesday yep. or whatever. People will be delighted to do that. But to say to them, you know what, you might have to just leave the meal on the doorstep because the person with cancer is not able to invite you in and to have a long cup of tea to discuss how they're doing. They're just not able for the moment. They're very grateful and in due course they will be. But so to have somebody nominated who will do all of that organising is incredibly helpful, I think, for family and friends and for the person with cancer. But I also say, especially for people who are close to the patient, be kind to yourself. Mm-hmm. It's a long road. It's a tough road. There's a lot of emotional and physical support required. So, you know, you need to look after yourself as well. If you look after yourself, you'll also be looking after the person, your loved one who has cancer, because, you know, it is a long road for many people and a difficult one.
When things don't go so well. Mm. And people are faced with the thing that no one wants to be faced with. That's phenomenally challenging, obviously, to deal with. Talk me through that situation.
So the last chapter that I wrote for that book was on dying, and I did not want to write it. I found it incredibly difficult. I focused on people that I have looked after who have died. But I feel very strongly, if we find it distressing and upsetting and frightening to talk about, what is it like for the person with cancer who's in that position? So we have to talk about it and we have to acknowledge it. Now, what I would say is everybody working in health and obviously family and friends, we want people to do well. We want people to survive and survive well, but it's not possible for everyone and we have to acknowledge it. What I would say is many people, they may not say, I'm dying. In fact, lots of people I looked after did not want to say that. They'd say, I know things are bad, but do not dare to take my hope away. I know things are bad. Now let's move on and talk about something else. So people will often say things like, I'm tired. I want to go home. I'm tired. I need a break. And, you know, they're really saying much more than that. And it is a very difficult time for the person, but it's an incredibly difficult time for the family. I've seen so many families literally gutted by knowing that that's what they face, because so often families manage, understandably, by being busy, by finding treatments, by finding help, by organising things, even if it's things like organising wheelchairs or, you know, whatever it is.
Stuff. Yeah.
And then suddenly they have to stop and say...
The stuff is distracting.
Yes. I mean, stuff is helpful for everybody, but it's a focus.
Hmm.
And now suddenly they have to sit down and say, that's it. Very, very, very hard for families. Very hard. They have to almost peel themselves off and to let go. That is incredibly difficult and requires such bravery on the part of everybody. The person in the position with cancer, yes, but often they are so tired and so physically overwhelmed that for them, they're almost not focusing on the fact that they're drifting away. But for families to let them go, it's horrendously difficult. But it's a very brave and wonderful thing to do. It's probably one of the most wonderful things is to be there with them, for them, for that time. Very difficult. But, it, you know, it has to be done sometimes.
We've had a fascinating chat. I've really enjoyed this. It's
Thank
a difficult you. Conversation to have, but it's an important conversation to have, I think. And for people listening in, we've covered a lot of ground.
Yes.
From both someone going through the diagnosis, but also from the support network around that diagnosis and the person who's going through it. I think would have brought people a lot of solace, hopefully, and some thoughts around the whole process, which is fantastic. Your book is called The Cancer Guide, How to Nurture Wellbeing Through and Beyond a Cancer Diagnosis. Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer, thank you so much for coming into the studio today and joining us and giving us really brilliant content around what people should do if they do get a cancer diagnosis in the future.
Thank you very much, Carl.
Folks, I really hope you enjoyed today's episode of Real Health. Me, Carl Henry. Fascinating content from an absolutely true expert in her field. As ever, you know where we are, at Carl Henry PT on Instagram, Real Health on the Irish Independent website. And as ever, we'll see you next week for more Real Health. Slán go fóill.